Hello and welcome to the Sonic Cinema Podcast. My name is Brian Scuttle. Thank you for joining me at www.sonic-cinema.com. You can listen to the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, whether it's Apple, Spotify, GoodPod, any podcatchers really that you listen to, as well as the Sonic Cinema Podcast YouTube channel, where you also find quick take reviews, little mini reviews that I do where I don't necessarily have a whole lot to say enough for a written review, but I do still have enough to say to have some thoughts on it beyond just a basic blurb or anything like that. And that is the Sonic Cinema Podcast YouTube channel. Click subscribe, rate, and review, though, wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also check us out at patreon.com/SonicCinema. The Oscar nominations are coming out soon. And though that will be discussed as we go through award season, I still have some movies to catch up, so I hope to do that, but that's at patreon.com/SonicCinema. So this year is going to be a bit interesting. This is the first episode of 2025, but we're kind of going backwards into an episode that I originally was hoping to do in 2024. We just kind of ran out of time, such as it is at the end of the movie year. And it is another episode in our Class of 1999 series. We've had a few more this year. And this is actually the second one I'm adding this year to the series with the same guests. The guest is Crooked Table host and Back to Bluey host, Robert Yannis Jr., and the movie is the 1999 Star Trek spoof comedy Galaxy Quest. Robert, thank you very much for joining me once again. It's good to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. I'm excited to dig into the historical documents with you.
It's funny because of the fact that I don't know about you. I know for me, I've always been much more of a Star Wars person than a Star Trek person. If you've listened to podcasts over the years, you know this about me. But I did see some Star Trek, certainly some of the films growing up, and certainly some of the original cast films. But the fact of the matter is, when Galaxy Quest came out, I basically knew enough of the lore of the original series to where you got a lot of the jokes in Galaxy Quest. And I think that is, and you know, this movie kind of came out like 30 years after the original series went off the air. Mm-hmm. And you know, by this point, the original series cast had already gone through their series of movies. We were in the middle of the Next Generation cast, and I think the same year is when Enterprise came out. And so Star Trek, but another thing that also came out this year, and this would have been a really fascinating double feature, is the documentary Trekkies, about the Trekkie fan base. And which I haven't seen. I'll admit I have not seen that. I've always been curious to see it, but I haven't had a chance to see it. And it's funny because of the fact that if you know me, you know I've gone to Dragon Con for 15 years now. And so I've been a bit more conscious of what science fiction genre movie conventions are. And sure. So there's something about this that is very believable to me, but you also see a little bit of the silliness of it too.
Yeah, I think that what makes this movie work so well is, first of all, like you, I was way more of a Star Wars person. Familiar with Trek, haven't seen a lot of the shows, saw some of the movies, ironically was most into Trek when the reboot, the Kelvin timeline movies came out, which I think were sort of criticized by some purists because they were more like Star Wars than Star Trek. And of course, JJ went on to do two of the three Star Wars movies in that most recent trilogy. But it's also, it's so iconic. Everything about that, like you get without ever having seen Star Trek that this is what it's sort of riffing on. But it's also like, it's the same kind of trappings, the whole, you know, we had this popular show slash movie that I think in this film, the Galaxy Quest series had gone off the air like 10, 15 years before or something like that. Yeah. So it's not as big of a gap, but it's also, you can apply that to Doctor Who. You can apply that to like any of a multitude of fandoms. Star Trek just happens to be the most well-known. And I think it works the best as a sort of Star Trek riff. But like, you know, I saw Spaceballs a long time before I saw Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And I got that it was a Star Wars parody without having to see Star Wars. Certain things are just part of the pop culture, you know, biosphere that we grew up around that, you know, it seeps through by osmosis to the point that there's a lot of classic movies I still haven't seen. Cause I'm like, I feel like I've seen that. Like I just watched on my show on Close Watch, we're doing movie musicals again for still/again. And I watched The Sound of Music for the first time in an upcoming episode. And it's like, it's just a movie that feels like it's everywhere. And so it's like, do I need to see it? You should see it.
Yeah.
But also you feel like you get it. And so you sort of put off kind of diving into it. And I think Galaxy Quest, what the miracle of this movie is that it works just as well for both types of fans. And then I have a really interesting take on this movie that we'll get into a little bit later, but that's kind of general thoughts. It's also part of a genre of movies that I really love, which are the, I'm a performer who is mistaken for being the real thing and then ends up sort of discovering like my inner strength and rising up and having to become that thing for real. See also Tropic Thunder, Three Amigos, A Bug's Life, School of Rock, and a million other movies. Like that's just a genre that always works for me. Yeah. So the fact that it happens to be steeped in sci-fi and kind of riffing on Trek specifically is just like a cherry on top.
Well, and it's funny because of the fact that, I do think that I do agree with you that this fits within that subgenre as well. And it's interesting because of the fact that all of those are essentially riffs on Seven Samurai in a way as well. Where it's the idea of getting these people to save a town or village or a alien race, and all of a sudden they're forced to really kind of be their characters, and it's really a fascinating little subgenre. The fact that this has come out of it. And I mean, it's I think a huge reason why this works as well as it does, and a big part of the reason where even if you're a Trek neophyte and have like never really watched anything of it, you understand the dynamics so perfectly because of the fact that the way the characters are written and the fact that you understand those personalities, like Jason Nesmith, the Tim Allen character, is very clearly William Shatner.
Absolutely.
The fact that everybody hates him is part of Star Trek lore. You know, Alan Rickman as Alexander Dane, very clearly supposed to be the Spock character, and who is a serious actor, but has found himself typecast in this role over the years. Sigourney Weaver, and it's like, you know, when it comes to Sigourney Weaver in this movie, I think it's kind of interesting where she's, you know, she's obviously being cast as a particular type of actress, one that is more, you know, recognizable for her physical attributes than what she brings as a performer. But I can't help but think that she was cast in this, A, because she's brilliant, but also because she's such a good foil for the broader comedic performances on the strength of what she does in the Ghostbusters movies.
Mm, yeah. It's also, she's playing this, it's, she's Ripley. So yeah. seeing Ripley in this movie be like, where her only job is to repeat what the computer is saying and to repeat Jason's like commands to the computer, like she's just go between.
Yeah.
Is hilarious. You have Sigourney Weaver, sci-fi legend, and it kind of going against type in that way. Yeah, I thought that was really fun as well.
Mm-hmm. But it's the way that some of the other cast members are sort of against type. Like you look at Tony Shalhoub as essentially Scotty in here, and he's so much drier than Scotty is in the original series.
Yeah.
And you know, you have Daryl Mitchell as Tommy, who, you know, was a kid when the series was still on. So you got a little bit of the Will Wheaton type thing. And but at the same time, he's also obviously, you know, Sulu or Chekhov or one of those type of characters.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then the hilarious thing, of course, is we have Sam Rockwell, which this was the first time. Because I don't remember if I had seen this or Green Mile first, but it was definitely, this was definitely his breakout.
Yeah, this, I think
this,
so.
This winter was definitely his breakout. And Sam Rockwell is Guy, you know, he's introducing the cast members at the convention, and he has a history. And it's funny because of the fact that he is, you know, before I went to conventions, he's sort of the joke parody type convention guest where it's like, oh, I played this character for like 15 seconds on one episode of, you know, and like, that's typically not who's at conventions. Right.
And he wants to join them at the signing early in the film. He's got his headshot ready to go. And it's also funny because he's essentially, like in Star Trek, what would be a red shirt?
Yeah.
He's like crewman number 6. He gets killed before the commercials.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're right. Sam Rockwell, I think, is the big discovery of this movie. Like, we all had seen Alan Rickman and Sigourney Weaver. And this is like midway, about 5 years into Tim Allen's like movie star run, where he was headlining. I don't know if people now realize that this guy was a sought after movie star from the Santa Claus until, I'd say, Wild Hogs was like the last gasp of the mainstream part of it.
Yeah.
And this, I think, probably, I wouldn't even say arguably, I would say it's probably his best film that he made, possibly even his best performance of that bunch.
I think live action, you're definitely right. But I mean,
yes.
Obviously, it's Toy Story 2 came out the exact same.
Well, winter, of course.
So it's
not counting,
it's hard
that.
To
yeah.
say it's his best movie, period.
Well, not counting Toy Stories, but yes.
And I mean, you know, it's funny. Your co-host on Back to Bluey and I, Darren Lundberg, we talked about Toy Story 2 in an episode before this, and no, I mean, I think that's easily between. But I do agree with you. I do think between that and Toy Story 2, like 1999 was the zenith of Tim Allen as a movie star.
Absolutely.
And yeah, I mean, I do think Wild Hogs was like really the last one, because I mean, it probably was not too far after that that he really kind of went back into TV. But yeah, I mean, it's, so yeah, he was in the mid 90s, and it was because of Home Improvement.
Ended the same year too, ended in 1999.
Yeah. I mean, it was all because of Home Improvement, and and then Santa Claus and Toy Story movies and stuff like that. Yeah, it was just one of those things where he had a fantastic 15-year run, and then he basically kind of just went. It was just that type of character was not really... I mean, there were a couple of other Toy Story movies after that. And, I mean, obviously we've got a fifth one coming out. But, yeah, it's one of those things where it's like he just was unable to really parlay that movie stardom into anything other than kind of family-friendly type comedies and stuff like that. Or, you know, light adult comedies that weren't particularly raunchy, but, you know, they had humor that adults would appreciate.
I think, too, a lot of that also you can kind of chalk up to the fact that Wild Hogs was 2007. Another thing that happened in 2007, the emergence of Netflix. Obviously, it hadn't really become like the streaming giant that it is now.
Yeah.
But like as that sort of emerged, those kinds of movies went to Netflix.
Yeah.
They went straight to streaming. They weren't a big theatrical release anymore. And yeah, obviously, I was excluding the Toy Story movies. I don't want people to come at me being like, over Toy Story 1, 2, 3. I'm like, well, I meant live action.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Live action. I mean, that's definitely true. I mean,
yeah.
You know, and he also did other as far as live action too, because I mean he also was in that Barry Sonnenfeld film Big Trouble, which and he was also in a bunch of other stuff that honestly is just not really you don't necessarily want to bring up. I mean Christmas with the Cranks, Shaggy Dog.
That was like the tail end.
Yeah.
That was like when we're on our way out. Yeah.
Joe Somebody, For Richer or Poorer, which was one of his earlier ones. Jungle mm-hmm. the Jungle. It's like, yeah, he was also in a lot of movies that just were not good at all.
Right.
And you know, that's one of the weird things about like the 90s and 2000s and stuff like that is that you know, you saw sort of these weird swings in terms of comedies that you just don't really see anymore.
Right.
I mean, if you do, like you said, they're kind of on Netflix or they're yeah. on a streaming service.
Even this movie with sort of the genre angle, it did okay theatrically. Like this yeah. is a budget of 45 and it's 71 domestically, 90 worldwide. So it like... Once it hit VHS/DVD, well, I guess DVD was, yeah, it was still VHS too at this time.
No,
it was VHS and DVD, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once it did that, it definitely turned a profit, but like it took a minute. It wasn't like it came out and was a blockbuster. It took some time, very much in keeping of these sort of sci-fi properties. It definitely became sort of a cult object and then has sort of, you know, snowballed into one of the, I think, better remembered comedies of the 90s and certainly of this year.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and this is... Yeah, I mean, it definitely... Well, and it's interesting because of the fact that, I mean, I do think to a certain extent is... I mean, that 170 million worldwide for a comedy is not bad at all. Mm. Like, it's actually really good. Even in the 90s, that's really good, especially with that budget. But yeah, because of the fact that I think, and it's because of the sci-fi trappings that I think is what makes it more of a cult item.
Right.
I mean, than anything. And yeah, it's one of those things where you just are, you're bowled over by this movie because of, and I love just how, this is a very deep cast.
Yeah, absolutely. Like
we talked about the main cast, but you also have Justin Long in this movie.
His first movie.
Yeah, is as one of the nerds, as one of the diehard fans. You have Missy Pyle as one of the aliens. Robin Sachs, who was a really good character actor, who I knew on Buffy.
Same, yeah.
And he plays Saris and does just a terrific job. And so, like, I wonder, I have to think, I wonder if they approached like any of the Star Trek cast for like cameos or something like that. I mean, I get why they probably wouldn't have necessarily done it, but it would have been interesting to see if they had been able to pull that off. But one of the things I like about this is because it does have very much a feel all its own.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the fact that it's such a, it plays with reality because of the fact that it's like, oh, this alien race has caught this TV show in like space and thinks it's real. And so they're trying to get the actual, you know, people that the actors are playing, and it goes sideways.
And the Gilligan's Island joke is so good.
Yeah.
Those poor people. and to that point, I love that this, since it is riffing incredibly obviously on Star Trek, that it does honor the sort of utopian aspects of that property that yeah. Gene Roddenberry had sort of envisioned. It's like, it's going to be, you know, this sort of society where everyone is living in harmony and all this other stuff. And it's very aspirational. And that's a big part of what made that show so groundbreaking. Mm-hmm. And here they pick up on Galaxy Quest, which is essentially this universe's version of Star Trek. And it saves their entire culture. Like,
yeah,
it like turns everything around because they based their entire society on the historical documents.
Yeah. 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 And, you know, it's wild that they basically, their entire spaceship is built based on the ship in the show. And there's so many wonderful moments where you see the absurdity of the TV show. And of course the, you know, when Jason and Gwen are trying to get somewhere near the end, and there's that gauntlet with everything, the trash master essentially. And yeah. It's like, who designs this? What purpose does this have?
This episode was badly written. I had it in my notes.
Whoever wrote this episode should die was her words. And it's like, oh my God. Yeah, that is absolutely true. But that plays into the comedy because of the fact that it goes to the absurdity of what would happen if real life aliens took a TV show as real and tried to create that, you know? And it's, you know, I mean, it's just really it's such a charming movie. And because of the fact that it's, and to your point, I think the dealing with the utopian aspects of Star Trek, I think, is a big part of it. And I like that the big betrayal is that Jason and the rest of the cast lied.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such an innocent idea that it just absolutely, you know, that absolutely breaks your heart when that truth comes out.
That's the other thing I think that is the big reason that this movie has endured is that, yeah, it's funny and it's got all these great actors and all that, but it also has a heart to it. Yeah. And all of these characters have some semblance of an arc.
Yeah.
You know, Jason Nesmith goes from like really leaning into it and really being full of himself and booking events without the rest of the cast and all of that to pulling them up on stage with him to really being humbled. And that confession scene is just, heart-wrenching. And you know, I want to make sure we shout out Enrico Colantani, who is so funny and also so heartbreaking in that scene. He was on Just Shoot Me at the time, another TV person. This is like a few years before Veronica Mars sort of gives him another hit series to work with. And then the Alan Rickman of it all. Alan Rickman is Alexander Dane, Dr. Lazarus. That scene later on where Quellic is dying in his arms and he embraces his character and he says the line that he made a big stink about not wanting to say. at the beginning of the film by Grabtharth Hammer, by the Sons of War Van, you shall be avenged. I thought that was, again, really sweet moment that he sort of understands, oh, there is meaning. There is, you know, this does mean something to people. I'm not doing Shakespeare, but people care. Like, it matters to them.
Yeah.
It matters to this guy who's dying in my arms, who I'm going to, like, give him that, like, last moment of sort of satisfaction and bliss, and I'm going to say the thing that he, you know, has been idolizing me from afar. I'm going to say the thing that he wants to hear. Yeah. And it's just really great. Like, all of the characters are so well developed. And like I said, they all have their arcs. I even think the visual effects hold up for the most part. There are a couple moments where, like, the little tiny aliens look a little wonky, or like the morph, the transporting effects look a little janky, but they're supposed to be enveloped in this like blue translucent goo. So it's like, you can kind of fudge around it. How did you feel about like the visuals in this kind of effects driven comedy?
No, I agree with you. I think they hold up very well after 25 years.
Exactly.
And I mean, you know, it's like, even if they don't quite hold up as well, I still enjoy them because of the fact that, it plays into the idea that the effects in these type of sci-fi shows are not necessarily built to hold up after 15, 20 years. And it really does play into the goofier aspects of like sci-fi shows, sci-fi TV shows for the most part. I mean, not everything is going to be like Battlestar Galactica or Firefly or very polished in the way that it looks. I think that completely works in this film's favor because of the fact that it does play to the silliness of the conceit. And yeah, you mentioned Rickman, and I still like rewatching this. It had been a few years since I'd seen it, I still think this is one of his best performances that he ever gave. He does such a great job of starting from the place of, I'm a serious actor and all I'm known for is this. What am I doing? To coming to accept it to where his eventual saying of that when Quillick passes away is, it makes it that much more impactful. It really does. And that's something that, you know, you look at his work as Snape, right? Especially in Deathly Hallows Part 2.
Absolutely.
And he has, that is one of the things that Rickman, obviously early in his career, Die Hard, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, very, very one-note characters in a lot of ways. Not one note, but
characters that take themselves very seriously.
That take themselves very seriously, and characters who don't really have a significant arc that they're going on in the movie. But you look at him in this one, you look at him in Harry Potter, and you can see just this transformation where our expectations of his character are one thing, and he continues to subvert it all the way to the end. And it is, he's got so many just wonderful moments. He was so, it's a shame he really did not get too many great comedies to do, because he's got some moments here that are absolutely hilarious. Like when he's saying the variation of the word, the phrase at the car dealership opening. And when he thinks he's in for this big celebratory moment and everybody's cheering for Jason, you know, when he saves everybody, and it's like, oh, the deflating moment. And but no, he's just so good in this.
It's also, it feels like his arc in this movie feels, obviously, as we said, as we alluded to, it's sort of very much riffing on Leonard Nimoy, who famously had a book, I'm Not Spock. And then later on, it's like, all right, they've released another book, I Am Spock.
Yeah.
And had his own sort of journey to accept that that's what he was going to be known for. But then, to your point about Rickman and his comedy, this same year he does Dogma, which he's tremendous in that as well. Yeah. So it's almost like I can see, it feels like you can track a direct link between Rickman's pre-Galaxy Quest career and then afterwards. Because, like, had he not played Alexander Dane in this movie, a character who's, like, you know, kind of stuffy in that, oh, I want to be doing, I did Shakespeare, I'm a classically trained actor, why am I doing this genre stuff? This is beneath me. And then turns around and does 8 Harry Potter movies. Would he have even wanted to do the Harry Potter movies had he not done something like this first? You know what I mean? Right. I mean, I know they were already sort of probably working on it, but like the way he committed to that character and became essentially one of the most popular elements of the Harry Potter films.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, and I mean, he also did Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy after this as well.
Yeah.
And it's, and I mean, I think that's one of the other, like, just truly out there comedic performances he gives. Because, I mean, looking at other movies in his career, I mean, he did Sweeney Todd, he did Perfume, he did Alice in Wonderland for Burton. So, I mean, yeah, to your point, he started doing much more genre work in this.
Yeah.
After,
and I was kind of checking the timeline a little bit. So this came out like Christmas 99, and then 8 months later, August 2000, reports are coming out about him in talks to play Severus Snape. So it was, so literally it hadn't happened yet until after this movie came out, which I think is maybe the reception to that. I like to think the reception of Galaxy Quest helped kind of nudge him to sign on to Harry Potter.
Yeah. No, I can see that being a possibility. Yeah. But no, there's just a lot of fun conceits in this. I love the David Newman score in this movie. He does such a great job of playing into that sort of original series Star Trek type music, but also doing something very much his own. The way this movie sets up the stakes is just absolutely perfect. And the fact that it takes Jason going back up with the rest of the crew to realize that, oh shit, this is something very different than what I anticipated. Like, when he first goes up in the ship, he just thinks it's, oh, well, this is, you know, this is promotional or this is PR or something like that, you know? And so he doesn't take it that seriously. And he starts to take it a little bit more seriously. And he's the one who's more excited about it than everybody else.
Yeah. And Tony Shalhoub has that, to your point earlier about the dry delivery, is like, what? He's like, that's a hell of a thing. He's just like shaking it off, like, wow, that's crazy. Like completely unaffected by traveling to the space.
Yeah, I mean, Shalhoub is he's great in everything. Yes. I mean, I was familiar with him from Wings before this. And then, of course, Men in Black, he's hilarious. And then, of course, Monk later. Right. But no, he's such a comedic weapon. And he does such a great job in this of finding his own. I like that everybody has sort of their own comedic rhythm in this.
Yeah.
And I think that is such an important part for a comedic ensemble like this. I mean, that's part of the reason why like stuff like Ghostbusters works too, because everybody's essentially doing their own type of humor. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a big part of why something like this works too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, you could tell it was made with real love and care for this genre, for, you know, geek culture as a whole. Like the fact that little details, like, and it's more of a movie, general movie trope than a specific sci-fi, but like the timer ending at the last second.
Yeah.
And like the like in-depth knowledge that these fans have of like the inner workings of the spaceship and the layout and, oh, this is how the duct system works and all of that. And that's the thing that really hit me upon this watch. Like, this isn't one I saw in theaters. I saw this on probably VHS, I think, around this time, DVD, early DVD. And then I watched it a few times over the years. I own the DVD. But, like, upon this watch, it really hit me that, like, this movie kind of snuck in, like, the last year or two where geek culture felt like a niche. Subculture.
Yeah.
Like, this is right on the cusp of all of that sci-fi, fantasy, superheroes going mainstream. This same year we had The Matrix, The Phantom Menace. A couple years later, like we said, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
You know, we start getting the Marvel, the first, not the MCU, the first Marvel wave of X-Men and Spider-Man and, you know, the Blade films and then Fantastic Four and all that other stuff. Going right into the Dark Knight trilogy and the MCU, like, so all of that like really kind of spirals after this. But this is like the last moment where, that's for nerds, that kind of thing, where that was like the sentiment at the time. Had this come out a few years later, it wouldn't have really fit. But I think they managed to make that happen right when that's about to change, which I think is really interesting. It makes this movie feel, in addition to the whole, you know, the Tim Allen A-list movie star of it all, it makes it feel like a time capsule in that way. It's like, oh, you remember when that wasn't everywhere? When Comic-Con wasn't like front page news on every entertainment site?
Well, and you're right. And the thing that this is also in the middle of, I mean, because Comic-Con was not what Comic-Con is now. This time, like, it still had a few years before it became this omnipresent, like, completely corporatized, oh, we're going to just go to Comic-Con to basically announce everything. Like, exactly. It was still a few years before that was really a thing. I mean, it was still obviously going on, but to your point, it was much more niche. But this is also coinciding with Ain't It Cool and Joe Blow, mm-hmm. and those type of websites where it's something that, to your point, it's still very much felt like a new type of culture coming in. And then you had Phantom Menace, you had The Matrix, and it was still very much playing. So, I mean, this was kind of, It was still that comic book guy type characterization of nerds. It was mm-hmm. years before the Big Bang Theory. And which, granted, I mean, is just another variation of that type of thing, but in a very different way. But still, like, so when you look at Justin Long and his friends in this movie, you're thinking of that type of stereotype. And I love the interaction that Justin Long's character ends up having with Jason when Jason calls him, and it's like, you know, okay, that's, you know, I mean Jason has to be humble and realize that it's like, I know I treat you like shit, and it's just such a great moment. And you know, you do feel like he becomes an actual, these nerds become actual characters, even if they're just like parts of a message chat and stuff like that as well.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's on the cusp of, to your point, internet culture really kind of blowing up.
Yeah.
Whereas fast forward 20, like when this came out, sci-fi was, you know, had this kind of hard sci-fi was very popular among a smaller audience. But then fast forward 20 years and 20 plus years, now multiverses are everywhere.
Yeah.
One of the highest grossing movies of the years of the year is Dune. Like, you know, it's a completely different world than it was.
I mean, I'm not sure how much I would consider like the multiverse films as, I mean, everywhere, everything, everywhere all at once. Yeah, I would kind of call that hard sci-fi, but like Marvel multiverse, I'm not sure how much hard sci-fi is in there. Dune definitely is, though.
How much did like the mainstream audiences know about a concept like the multiverse? I guess at this point is where I'm getting at.
I think they've kind of, I feel like because
comic
of Marvel,
book people,
Marvel,
yeah,
because of Everything Everywhere All at Once, they're probably more familiar with it now than they were.
Yes.
No, I would agree with that. But yeah. I'm like, yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, Marvel is not exactly hard sci-fi. Like,
well,
hard sci-fi.
No.
Dune is definitely hard sci-fi. But it's like, I don't know Marvel's hard sci-fi. I think a lot of hard
sci-fi. It's a different genre. It's not like hard. Yeah, it's when I'm lumping together all of the air quote geek culture, like the hard sci-fi.
Yeah.
The Tolkien stuff.
Yeah.
And then the Marvel and all of that. Like different, those are different genres, but they're all kind of, at least when I was a small child, they were all kind of lumped into, oh, like that's geek stuff. That's like popular, but like hadn't really become like, oh, everyone, even people who don't go to see movies went to see Avengers Endgame or whatever.
Right.
It's not like the thing like it would become later.
No, this was definitely, no, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, this was definitely in that moment where it's like, you know, even, I mean, Star Wars and The Matrix, to your point, as far as this year, were really the only sci-fi movies that people across broad spectrums of the audience went to go see. Now, I mean, granted, Matrix was not the hit that Phantom Menace was, but it was still very omnipresent by the end of the year, and it left the bigger cultural footprint than Phantom Menace did, even though Phantom Menace was by far the higher grossing of the two films.
Absolutely.
But no, I mean, yeah, it's interesting to look at it. Is I do think that is an important context for Galaxy Quest, because, you know, and then 10 years later Star Wars would get kind of their own thing with Fanboys. But that was from a different perspective, because that was people trying to sneak into Skywalker Ranch and get their hands on Phantom Menace.
Right.
And, you know, very different thing. I mean, Edgar Wright's Spaced, I think, came out this year, too. The TV show. So, it was definitely at that moment where geek culture was starting to take over, and I do wonder what this would have been like if this had come out in like 2002, if this would have been bigger.
Probably, yeah.
I mean, just because of the fact, I mean, again, not that it wasn't successful, was, but it also would have been, like, X-Men will have been a hit at this point. Spider-Man will have been more of a hit at this point. You would have had Lord of the Rings. You would have had Harry Potter. You would have had that bigger footprint of genre just dominating the box office in a way that we really were starting to see, but was still very varied in terms of what were the big hits in the late 90s.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to check into where Trek was itself. Like you said, this is like on the tail end of Voyager's run, a couple years before Enterprise kicks off, And this is right between Insurrection and Nemesis as far on the movie side. So it was not a great time for Trek fans, on the big screen at least.
Yeah.
So it's, again, sort of that petering off of that franchise for a little bit, like at least a break period.
Yeah, and then really, I mean, it was basically, with the exception of the Kelvin timeline, I mean, really, it's been exclusively on TV since then.
Mm-hmm.
Since Nemesis. And yeah, I mean, it's like, I think, you know, we've already talked on like a lot of my points with bullet points with what I wanted to get to with this movie.
Yeah.
Because there's not a whole lot to say about it. It's like, if you've seen this movie, it's just a charming film. I mean, it really is just a charming, entertaining film. I mean, if I were more of a Star Trek fan, I can see myself going into even greater depth about all of the different lore and all of the different references and stuff like that that are going on in this. But at the same time, I mean, you know, I'm not, but I get enough of it to where I appreciate it. And, your perspective of this as its place in geek culture almost more than in sort of Star Trek adjacent culture, I think both of those are kind of hand in hand in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But I mean, geek culture, I think, is definitely the more pronounced of the two because of the fact that it's basically actors from a series getting roped into a situation that is way above their heads. And then really they rope the fans in to this situation themselves.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to see that give and take of how it happened.
And it's validating for fans who are passionate about this kind of stuff. They literally help save the universe in this film. And it's validating for the artists who create this kind of stuff. Like, look how much this matters to people. So there are people maybe who don't view them as historical documents per se, but there are people to whom that means a great deal or got them through a tough time or helped them understand something about themselves or the world. Like you mentioned Buffy earlier, like that's a great example of kind of sci-fi horror genre material being used as, you know, allegories for a lot of real life issues and topics. And I think, you know, this movie is sort of like a big stamp of approval for geek culture as a whole. Again, like I said, right before everyone's like, okay, we're fine with it now. We're all going to embrace this.
Right.
We get it. It's not taboo to like comic books or hard sci-fi or Lord of the Rings or whatever the case may be. I also think it's prescient in a way too, because this movie ends with them doing a reboot of the Galaxy Quest series. Which feels like, wow, that's everything now. That is our culture.
Oh, yeah. So much of it is reboots now. I mean, whether it's on TV or in movies, yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, you brought Buffy again. And, I mean, I was certainly in my Buffy fandom at the time. But it made me think of a movie we just saw this past year come out. I saw The TV Glow, kind of is... which is taking a very different look at that type of fandom in a way that I resonate with because of the fact that it's like, I know, but is to your point where it's like, it's something that very much gets you through a difficult time, makes you really start to figure out who you are as an individual because of the moment that you're watching it in. And it's doing, I mean, it's obviously not as overtly comedic as Galaxy Quest is, but it's capturing the same sense of love of material and what that means when you're when you find yourself in a situation where you engage with it even an even deeper level than you expected to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I've seen that movie twice, and personally, like, I respect it. It's a movie that I respect more than I love, but I mean, I understand completely why the people who love it do love it. And, it's just kind of an interesting, coda, and you bring up Buffy in this way, it kind of made me think that would be a good thing to bring up in this case, because of the fact that it is very much, the TV series I Saw the TV Glow is very much lifted from Buffy. 100%. It's very much inspired by Buffy.
Yeah.
And yeah.
I think it's also interesting to note that the Galaxy Quest in and of itself, even though it's riffing on Star Trek, was supposed to get some kind of a sequel at one point. Like, there was talk of a sequel film or like a TV series of some kind. I think Alan Rickman's death in 2016 sort of, like, if not killed that project, definitely slowed it way down.
Yeah.
Because as recent as 2023, there were talks of a TV show, but nothing really happened yet. I wouldn't be surprised if we still see something like that at some point. I don't think we need it, but
yeah.
Again, did the world need Galaxy Quest, The Journey Continues in this movie? I don't know. It made a lot of people happy. So
yeah, it would be hard. I feel like it would be hard to get all of the main cast, sans Rickman, to agree to that. I can almost see it maybe being done in like comic book form. Like, mm-hmm. Which Buffy did, where it's like they did a lot of sequel seasons to Buffy and Angel and Firefly and stuff like that. I can almost see it kind of being that way. I can't see this ever being rebooted, though. You just need the comedic dynamics of the original cast. But yeah, to your point, maybe a legacy sequel, but yeah, without Alan Rickman, it's so hard to consider that.
It's also wild to watch this movie and be like, all these actors, Sam Rockwell's the only one that has an Oscar, which is interesting. Yeah, over Alan Rickman and Sigourney and all these
Rickman,
people.
But I mean, Rickman never got nominated.
I don't think so. Which
blows my mind.
You
would have thought like Die Hard, or maybe not Prince of Thieves, but at least like, or Love Actually, or Harry Potter. But I mean, Harry Potter, like, fantasy genre, it's such a hard thing for an actor to get nominated for anyway. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it baffles me. I mean, I would have loved to have seen him nominated for this. He would have been fantastic.
Yeah.
That Murderer's Row of actors this year. Like, I would put him over Michael Caine in this any day for supporting actor any day of the week. I mean,
Michael Caine, who won for Cider House Rules, I think, this year, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was his second win.
I feel like nowadays he would have gotten nominated for in a world where Ryan Gosling is nominated for playing Ken.
Yeah.
I think that it definitely was in the, would have been in the realm of possibility.
Well, I mean, the thing I will say about Gosling is Ken. I mean, yeah,
and I love him in that too. That's not shade at Gosling.
Oh no, he's amazing in it. But at the same time, I do think that movie was, that nomination was helped by the fact that movie was a juggernaut.
100%.
And I mean, this obviously was not on that level as of success, unfortunately. But no, I mean, I would have traded that Kane nomination for Rickman any day of the week, whether it's for this or Dogma. He was great in both of them. We talked about Dogma. I talked about Dogma in a different episode for the class of 1999, and yeah, it's just absolutely terrific. I do want to say, it's funny because of the fact that it's interesting, these last few episodes of class of 99, have come at a very weird time, because all three of them have been recorded after the 2024 election. Mm-hmm. And obviously when I did my introduction on the World Is Not Enough discussion with Kevin, I talked about how sort of my mission statement with this podcast is to spread positivity in cinema, which is not to say that we're going to love everything
right.
that we talk about, but at least we're going to be respectful to the filmmakers, you know, and it was something that obviously came up when Darren and I were talking about Toy Story 2. I was thinking about this record today, and we're recording this on the day of Trump's re-inauguration. And, I just want to say, you know, Jason Nesmith, you know, this is ultimately about this movie is ultimately about people who are a race that's oppressed and has to find its will to fight against an awful, brutal individual.
Mm.
And I just want to kind of close this discussion by bringing up Jason's iconic line, never give up, never surrender. I think that's basically where a lot of us are at this point. And, Robert, thank you very much once again for joining me on the podcast. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Brian. I mean, this is a movie that's really easy to talk about. Like, it's 100 minutes. It's light. It's breezy. It's smart. It's hilarious. A lot, like I said, a lot of heart. And as you just said, a great message of sort of perseverance and unity. And I think that's definitely something that people could use right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Where can people find Crooked Table and Back to Bluey?
So you can find the Crooked Table Productions shows. That's Close Watch, where we get to know our guests through the movies they love. As I mentioned, right now we're doing movie musicals. This year we're doing a bunch of them up front. Then we're kind of switching mini seasons of both shows. And then the other show is Franchise Detours, where we believe no movie series travels in a straight line. We're going to be doing the Before trilogy, Naked Gun, the Superman films, kind of leading into James Gunn's new one, the Toy Story movies, as we discussed. So I'll be talking to Tim Allen at some point later this year. And you can find those on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Good Pods, wherever you get your podcasts at. And then also Back to Bluey is available on all the podcatchers as well. That's where Darren and I break down the Australian animated series Bluey one episode at a time, talk about the lessons that we glean from the episode, how we connect to it as parents ourselves, and find a way somehow to break a 7-minute episode into like 30, 40 minute conversations sometimes. we recently posted an episode on the Bluey episode Stickbird, where we did an in-depth conversation about our complicated reactions to the announcement of the Bluey movie. So people can find that everywhere as well. Both shows are also on social media, Instagram and Blue Sky and Threads. So please give us a listen. Let us know what you think.
I'm going to be very fascinated to hear who you get to cover Superman 3 and Superman 4. that is going to be fascinating.
Me too.
Another question with Superman, are you going to tie in the Richard Donner cut into the discussion on Superman 2, or is that going to be its own thing?
So, I believe that Darren is going to do Superman 2 with me, and we've talked about doing the Richard Donner cut as sort of a side conversation. Okay. That will probably end up on the Crooked Table Patreon. We did something similar because I did the Deadpool films last year, and I had him on to talk about Once Upon a Deadpool.
Okay.
Which kind of released in concert with the Deadpool 2 coverage. Yeah. But the other thing that's interesting, that's notable about that, is that So that Superman, we call them mega series over in Franchise Detours, that is going to not only cover Superman 1, 2, 3, 4, but also Supergirl and Superman Returns, which are essentially all part of the same.
Right. Basically, you know, basically everything up to the DCEU.
Correct.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, wow, Supergirl. That's going to be another fascinating one. I mean, including Superman Returns in there makes a lot of sense as well, just because of the fact that it's very much its own thing, and you can tell that it's very much inspired by, like, the Richard Donner movie, but at the same time, like, it's got so much of the Donner thing that it's like, you can't help, it's kind of a weird, in this weird middle area where it's its own thing, but it kind of isn't.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's probably part of what that conversation will discuss, is that it didn't lean into owning that that canon in the way that maybe it presupposed that it would, but it also didn't cut ties with it either. It cherry picked which ties it wanted to hold on to. Yeah. And I don't think that's how it works. I mean, you either have to even tried to do the whole Halloween thing of, well, we're going to be a sequel to Superman 2. Yeah. And we're going to ignore 3 and 4, but it doesn't even honor everything that happened in Superman 1 and 2. And it's also like, which version of Superman 2?
Yeah, exactly.
the one that Donner handled or the one that Richard Lester took over? So it's a whole messy conversation that I look forward to getting into.
Well, and it's funny that you mentioned that, because the Donner cut did not come out until that summer.
Yeah.
Because it came out concurrently with Superman Returns. So that's going to be a fascinating conversation. I cannot wait to hear all of those discussions. And Robert, as always, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks, Brian.
I'd like to thank Robert for joining me on the podcast. As always, it's a pleasure to talk to him, and I look forward to doing so again in the future. That's going to be it for this episode of the Sonic Cinema Podcast. We're going to be going in a few different directions with the podcast. We're going to have some familiar guests with you, but we're also going to have some really interesting conversations. And we're going to have kind of an impromptu tribute to a legend who recently passed away. We're going to talk about a particular type of film that feels very relevant now. And I also am going to be returning to Renegade Film Festival, so you will get coverage on that, as well as Atlanta Film Festival, as well as my Oscar discussion, and much more this year. Thank you very much for listening. Click subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts, as well as checking out patreon.com/SonicCinema, but always everything else you can find at www.sonic-cinema.com. Thank you very much.